This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. From the Bee Gees to Gloria Gaynor to the Village People, disco music transformed the airwaves during its heyday in the 1970s. And while the genre was wildly popular, it also had plenty of haters. A new episode of PBS's series American Experience explores the so-called war on disco, and it features big names in Chicago's music scene, including Ayanna Contreras, music and content director at our sister station, Vocalo. Now, we spoke to Ayanna about disco and what's going on over at 91.1 FM, and Ayanna began by telling us how disco got started and why it became an iconic American sound.
It's very interesting, actually. You know, a lot of folks want to have a creation myth around it, right? So if we're going to have a creation myth around disco as we know it, I would argue it probably was bubbling up in New York City in the early 1970s. But the term disco was applied to the idea of playing records and dancing in a club as far back as, you know, the 1960s or so. Mm-hmm. But the full term was discotheque. Like, that was the term that they were using at that time. You know, from there, those sorts of clubs became popular all throughout the country, places like, of course, San Francisco and Chicago.
Yeah. Well, in the PBS documentary, you talk about a record that a store in Brooklyn picked up that became really popular across the country. Let's listen to a little bit of that. So it's got a pretty funky, familiar beat.
Right.
I'm still waiting for my favorite part to come. But how did it become so popular at that time?
So it's very interesting. 1972, the record store African Record Center, which is in Brooklyn, imported that record from France, as a matter of fact. At that time, Manu Dibango was situated in France from Cameroon originally and had this real barnstormer of a record that got picked up by a DJ, Mancuso, as a matter of fact, at The Loft, which was a early disco club in New York. And it just was burning up the clubs. It was burning up the clubs. And then the radio picked it up. And then it was in people's homes all over the country, ultimately. Mm-hmm. Got distributed on Atlantic Records, one of the largest record labels in the United States at that point. But it's just such a funny record that combines African rhythms and jazz and funk. Mm-hmm. It's just really beautiful gathering of sounds, meeting of minds, so to speak.
So good. So good. I love how one person in the doc described the emerging genre. How disco could be thought of as a secularized form of gospel.
It could be thought of in a lot of, I mean, yes, there's that collective.
So you agree with that?
The collective, I think that was Adam Green, actually, from the University of Chicago. Yeah, the exhale, the collective exhale, especially for marginalized people. But the other thing that was very interesting about disco was that it was a very cosmopolitan scene. You know, there's discos in Rio, there's discos in Paris, there's discos in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. Like, this was just like a huge thing that was sort of, I don't know, I'd like to think global in some ways.
And we were both kind of shaking our shoulders there. But how do those early disco songs make you feel when you listen to them now in 2023?
Well, you know, the nice thing about that period, so 72, 73, 74, which I call proto-disco because it wasn't like the white suit disco quite yet. You know, very often very funky, very like liberatory, very like kind of often sort of underground and maybe even a little gritty, like very exciting music, I think.
Tell us more about the role that Chicago played and how it developed.
It's interesting because I wouldn't argue that Chicago was a big town for disco, but most of the biggest artists from Chicago ultimately left their mark on disco, including, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire had a number of huge hits. Even the group Chicago even dabbled their foot into it with songs like Street Player. So I think we had something to contribute. But in terms of the nightlife, there were so many clubs that ultimately became sort of prototypical of what disco was. And there was also a lot of music distribution that was based in Chicago at that time, like record distribution and record pools. So they were helping to get that music out to the masses in really big ways.
And so like on a regular basis, you could go out and you could hear this stuff in the clubs.
Absolutely. But different stuff in different clubs because, you know, it is Chicago and segregation is real. So, you know, even within the disco clubs, there was a delineation point between one audience going here like a Dugan's or something, or one artist going like down to what people think of as where house was ultimately born. So like there's different audiences in different places.
And we'll talk a bit more about that. You talk about how a lot of disco had a feminist message, and it makes me think of this song by Gloria Gaynor.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. And I grew strong. And I learned how to get along. And saw your back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed.
So let's get into that, Ayana. I mean, how did the disco scene support women, particularly women of color, in the ways that they hadn't seen the music industry do before?
Well, you know, a lot of female-fronted music was really in the forefront of disco music. And I'll say, as a person who's DJed for 20 years and one of my specialties is doing disco stuff from this era, what I know is that the ladies hold court. Like, I can play a male group, and in rock and soul and R&B, a lot of the times it's a male-centric sort of situation when people think about these historical genres. But with disco, if you want to energize the dance floor, you put on a lady who's belting it out and who is not taking anything from anyone. And you think about this, you know, this happened right alongside the women's liberation movement. There's a lot of liberation movements happening, you know, simultaneously. And there are some anthems that came out of that. You know, that's the thing that I want to make sure that people who think about disco as being this sort of vapid genre understand that, yes, that happened, but there was also a lot of very powerful songs that came out of it.
Yeah, and disco was a liberation, to your point, for so many people, but at the same time, others felt that it was oppressive, particularly white middle-class people. Why?
You know, I think, you know, there were folks, because I can't speak for the disco sucks contingency. I've said this a couple of times. I can't really speak for like why they attach themselves to that. And it wasn't everybody, because there's definitely folks of every race, creed, and culture who love disco to this very day. But there were folks who felt like it was the antithesis of what rock and roll was about. I think there was ideas of rock and roll being more egalitarian, which obviously that's not necessarily the case, you know. But there's ideas of, you know, the velvet rope as being exclusionary practice. You know, I mean, there's all these things. And you know, the materiality.
What do you make of that?
I mean, I think I don't like to take, you know, people today, genre, the term genre is sort of falling out of favor when people talk about music. People love to say that they're blending genres or blurring genres. But back then, genres were much more rigid. And maybe people wanted to put these prescriptives on what genres were and what genres weren't. But if you look at the long form of it, it's always been moving targets in terms of what something was, what rock was. I mean, you think about it, there was sometimes a conversation about disco being, you know, like the males looked effeminate with these open shirts and the polyester and the chains and all of that. But
right,
if you think about rock and roll in the late 1960s, sort of the peacock revolution where people are wearing feathers and velvet and all of these things. And it was just as rock as anybody. Like, I mean, look, Jimi Hendrix, I would wear that outfit. Whatever he was wearing, I would wear that outfit.
Oh, he was flying.
And all of that. Yeah, absolutely. So it's all just very circular if you think about it.
Interesting. You know, but all of that, though, it built to this disco demolition night in July of 1979 over at Comiskey Park in Chicago. What happened? I mean, I've seen old video footage. People were just spilling out from all over.
Yeah, you
onto
know,
the field.
So the Loop, the radio station, the Loop, and Steve Dahl was a big part of that, and they were promoting it for a Sox game that they didn't anticipate would have a ton of people, and they were like, well, what if we do a thing where for the, like, a 50-cent admission, something to that effect, you bring in a quote-unquote disco record as price of admission with the 50 cents, and we'll take it to the middle of the field and blow it up.
It was 98-cent tickets.
Okay. I mean,
still,
yeah. But you go in, you blow the thing up, right? And I mean, I'm telling you, pyrotechnics and teens, it's a match made in heaven. And then they had liquor. And then you knew that, it was very clear that something would happen. And I say in the documentary, you know, some people think that this was like an intentional sort of lynching of culture. And I honestly think that it was just more, what's the word? Just more like anarchy, like let's have a little anarchy, let's blow some things up and like blow off some steam type thing.
Yeah.
I mean, were there people who thought of disco as being shorthand for these other people, you know, and they were also mad about the burgeoning Rust Belt and disenfranchisement? And like, yeah, absolutely. There was definitely people were touching on these feelings that were real. That was actually part of what was causing this underneath. But I don't know that that was the intention of the thing. I know that when the control was lost and people were injured, I know that that wasn't the intention.
Back to where you mm-hmm. left off mm-hmm. there, you know, many stations, they stopped playing disco kind of almost overnight.
Right.
But disco didn't die, right? That eventually evolves into house music.
Correct.
Here
I
in
mean,
Chicago.
Here for sure, 100%.
Here in Chicago.
That's
yeah.
my vote.
Talk about that and your relationship with that scene.
So here is the thing. One of the things I also mentioned in the doc is that ultimately anything that's shoved down people's throats is going to like have a backlash. Like, I think that's a natural element of like the life cycle of an art form, you know, making it into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens after that? It goes back into the underground, which is good because the underground is where creation happens. It's where incubation happens. It's where, you know, it's removed from commodification and it sort of becomes sort of art for art's sake. And I think, you know, the small like house clubs and the little like Catholic school sock hops and sours, they had a little teen guy putting together like house things in the back. Like, that is where this worldwide music phenomenon really gained its wings.
I love that. So you wrote a book, an awesome book. It was talking about Black artists and entrepreneurs in the music scene. It's called Energy Never Dies, Afro-Optimism and Creativity in Chicago. That Afro-Optimism phrase. Tell us about that. I mean, how does Chicago embody Afro-optimism?
You know, it's like you have to believe something is better. I mean, think about these migrants, right? Like, they're going to an unknown place and they have to believe that something is better to push them through this trauma.
You're talking about the new arrivals that have come
today,
here
right.
from the southern border.
But I like to think that Black Americans also were escaping trauma in the American South and heading to cities such as Chicago, which was a huge mecca throughout the mid 20th century for African American people trying to build a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we suffered from redlining and, you know, discrimination and other discriminatory practices, I'd say, but we also were left alone to our own devices with a whole lot of creativity to create a lot of things based on our belief that we could. And we did.
You write that Black Chicago is unique from other strains of Black culture. How so?
I think so. I think there's sort of there's definitely an optimism. I like to quote Leslie Guy, and I think Leslie was like, I don't know how how this one phrase that I told you became so like, you know, stuck in my craw in a positive way so much. But she said, she's originally from Philadelphia. She was at one point a curator at the DuSable Museum. And she said, the thing that strikes me about Black Chicago is hearing people talk about the happenings and what's going on. It always feels like it's on the verge of spring. Like, it's everyone's leaning forward, like something's about to happen.
That's interesting.
Yeah. the best is in front of us. I mean, we've done a lot, but the best is in front of us, no matter what.
I'm also thinking about Black publications that started here, right?
Absolutely.
Ebony, Jet, Soul Train.
Right.
Right? Cultivating that culture.
That's right. I mean, the thing about Ebony and Jet, and there's a whole chapter in the book about Ebony and Jet in particular.
Where do you think I learned all the details from reading your
book? The great thing about Ebony and Jet in particular is they're broadcasting this new definition of what it is to be Black in America and in the world. You know, this identity of, yes, we can, and let's go ahead and do this thing. Like, let's, Black is beautiful, and here are all the myriad reasons why. And of course, it's definitely not about putting anybody else down. You know, I'm actually quoting Curtis Mayfield, where there was a song that he put out that folks had decided was implicitly racist because it was talking about we are a winner. But really, it wasn't about anyone else. It was just about the unflappable belief that we are a winner. Within ourselves, we have what it takes to overcome whatever thing is holding us back.
You're the host and producer of the weekly radio program Reclaimed Soul. It airs on WBEZ Friday nights at 10, as well as on Vocalo on Thursday nights at 8 and Sunday mornings at 9. I want to give folks a little taste.
I'm Ayanna Contreras, and you're listening to Reclaimed Soul. Before this, you actually heard local music from the Reverend Stanley Keeble and the Voices of Triumph with Can't You Love Him? It's interesting because it's arranged and produced by Marvin Yancey, the guy behind all that stuff, those hits with Natalie Cole, like This Will Be an Everlasting Love, right? Didn't know he did some gospel too, did you? That's the guy who arranged that particular song. And before that, we heard Syl Johnson and the Pieces of Peace with Concrete Reservation. And we also heard Howard Tate with She's a Burglar. We're getting ready to take a break. And when we come back, my girl, and I hope she's your girl too, Linda Jones. Stick with me.
I love that so much. You know, I'm so in awe of your deep wealth of knowledge on soul music, Ayanna. I wasn't kidding when I said I've learned so much since moving here and getting to know you. What's your favorite part about sharing this music and just making people feel so good?
Well, you know, one of the things is there's sort of a dual audience for Reclaimed Soul. One of which I'm really affirming a reality of remembrance and, you know, this is the music of my life type of connection to it. But then there's people who really don't have that knowledge and are just on that musical discovery journey. And I'm hoping with the show, I can really, like, you know, cater to both of those audiences and meet people where they are. That's the point. Like, you know, it's a very come as you are program.
Come as you are. Ayanna Contreras is the music director and director of content at Vocalo Radio on 91.1 FM. And she's also the author of the book Energy Never Dies, Afro-Optimism and Creativity in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This episode of the podcast was produced by Brenda Ruiz and Ethan Schwab, who edited it along with Dan Tucker. If you enjoy conversations like this, consider liking and subscribing to our podcast. We drop episodes daily, host a live show, and we bring you the latest news through our newsletter. If you haven't already, sign up at wbez.org/resetnews. That's all for Reset today. Thanks for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk again soon.